You're listening to a classic business podcast as heard on Classic 1027. 1027.
Well, we've gone from the big C being COVID to the big C being corruption. The stories being revealed about corruption relating to PPE makes one think it stands for public procurement enrichment. Nomvula Mokonyane's daughter, Ace Magashule's sons, the president's spokesperson, all became the latest cadres to be caught with their hands in the pockets of the poorest. And the argument inside the ANC-NEC meeting over the weekend went along the lines of there's nothing wrong for family of the ANC-NEC doing business with the ANC government if these NEC members are not public office bearers. And it's the sort of twisted ethical logic that shows any attempt at cleaning things up from the desk of the president, as we saw in his missive on Monday, is sadly PR spin, or certainly being perceived as such. It's worth noting that China executed its top justice official in the city of Chongqing as part of a crackdown on corruption a few weeks ago. That's when Wen Quang, a former director of the Chongqing Municipal Judicial Bureau, was convicted of accepting bribes and also of rape and shielding criminal gangs. Now, dozens of officials have been prosecuted as part of this clampdown initiated by Chongqing's Communist Party boss Bo Zhilai. Now, there's some ideology we could actually borrow from China. To talk about the other pandemic that has infected our society for decades, corruption, let's welcome our guests, Paul Hoffman, Director of Accountability Now, Colin Coleman, Senior Fellow and Lecturer at Yale University's Jackson Institute for Global Affairs, ex-CEO of Goldman Sachs, and a good friend of the President, and Wayne Duvenage, CEO of Outer, the organization Undoing Tax Abuse. Colin, kick us off. You presented a 10-point plan to turn the economy around, and I'd argue we have more than enough plans floating around, and without tackling the runaway corruption, you can forget about building anything or any PPE-led infrastructure rebuilding of the economy. You do touch on corruption in point three, so it is high up on your list. Interestingly, we are better placed than many other African countries to tackle this problem. There are 13 public sector agencies that have a particular legal or policy role to play in combating graft, yet we still struggle to get our hands around this particular nettle. Why do we struggle with corruption still 2 years into this new administration?
Yeah, Michael, it's certainly a curse on South Africa at this point in time, and the rot is extremely deep, you know, and obviously the Zuma years set off a structural issue in the party where effectively state capture provided a route to a gravy train, which I think the current president is battling to arrest and to rein in. So my 10-point plan effectively talks about overhauling the economy in such a manner that it creates the conditions for corruption not to persist. And obviously, you know, the question is, what is the root cause of corruption in South Africa? And it relates clearly to the structural problems in our economy of economic exclusion, colonialism, and so on, which has caused the African community, clearly, you know, over 80% of our population, to have much less participation in our economy than they should have. And unfortunately, the process has created a dynamic where, you know, the political kingdom is a route to patronage and to cronyism and to effectively gaining economic cake, an economic share of the cake through undemocratic, illegal, criminal activity. And we have to deal with these twin problems of low economic growth and exclusion and corruption at the same time.
It reminds me, Colin, of what Smuts and Gunyama famously said, we didn't struggle to be poor. And that's a mentality that has certainly provided a sort of common cultural shield inside the ruling party to get away with what from the outside looks to be clear and rampant corruption. Paul, from your perspective, I know at Accountability Now you've been lobbying hard for the Integrity Commission for years now and on the structural changes that we need to see to fight corruption. Just remind us why the multi-agency system has been such a dismal failure.
Yes, the trouble with multi-agency system, which I see from his letter yesterday, the president still wishes to persist with, is that it's illegal and it also doesn't work. It's illegal because the Constitutional Court has held that the single entity approach is appropriate in South Africa. And it doesn't work because the experience with the anti-corruption task team and the experience with this hub and the new fusion will follow that experience, is that the various agencies play tennis with each other and very often say, yours partner, when a smash is hit between them. So you do not get a coordinated, coherent, and dedicated response. This in spite of the fact that the very first of the criteria set down by the Constitutional Court is that a dedicated, specialized entity is required to deal with corruption with impunity, which has become endemic for the reasons that that Colin has sketched. The impunity is really what makes corruption grow. People who go into politics to make profit are on a dwaalspoor anyway. You don't go into politics to make profit. You go into politics to serve people. That's been forgotten about in the patronage, cronyism, nepotism that you mentioned in your introduction. What we really need is a single agency which complies with the criteria laid down by the Constitutional Court. If I've said this once, I've said it a million times, but I'm going to say it once more for your viewers. It must be STIRS compliant, specialized, properly trained, independent of executive control and interference and influence, resourced in a manner that is guaranteed and secure in its tenure of office. You ask me, will that work? The answer is, it worked while the Scorpions were doing the job as a single agency, but the Scorpions had an Achilles heel. They did not enjoy security of tenure of office because they were a creature of a simple, ordinary statute, and as a consequence of that, it was possible when Zuma came to power to close down the Scorpions by a simple majority in Parliament. Had the Scorpions been part of a Chapter 9 institution, it would not have been possible to close them down because a special majority would be required to do so, and in the face of opposition from every single opposition party in Parliament, it would not have been possible for the first Zuma administration to replace Scorpions with hawks. And as we know, the hawks have been less than a success. Indeed, it seems that the president has written them off as appropriate investigators of corruption. They have other priority crimes to attend to, and they seem to do rather better on those than they do on the thorny issue of corruption, which is really just above their level of clout and competence to deal with.
And Advocate Hoffman, as you've so succinctly detailed, the answer is right there for the single agency system. Bob Glenister, at great personal expense, litigated us to that position where we've got the Constitutional Court ordering a single prosecutorial institution to combat corruption. So why, I think the question perhaps to you, Wayne, why when we have the solution on a silver platter, is the president not implementing something like this? How can we take him seriously when he writes letters, when he talks about corruption being akin to hyenas feasting on the carcass? How can we take him seriously if he doesn't want to implement the structural reforms required?
Well, exactly. It's the same question we have of him as well. I mean, it's just so obvious what has to be done. As Paul said, it's not rocket science. This, if you want to display meaningful approach to fighting corruption, then you need to introduce all these mechanisms and to give the power, so to speak, to these the institution to tackle this matter. You know, the NPA and the SIU and the Assets Forfeiture Unit, they're all there. We've got so many oversight mechanisms, as Colin speaks of, and Paul. The problem is, if they are have been hollowed out, if they have been diminished over time and largely so, we sit here today with a massive backlog to get on top of the problems. We need to see accountability and we need to introduce transparency. Those are the two key areas. But until the, there's a lot of talk of the president with his hands tied behind his back, these two centers of power that come into play, the pushback cabal, the Zuma cabal, which still reside largely in many of these institutions, by the way, putting up all the barriers and blockages. And until we tackle those issues and until the president starts to give power to what is required, we are going to labor away, and that's what's happening. It's far too slow. You know, in many countries where the rule of law flows, it takes far less than what has already been presented to the authorities to have people behind bars by now. So it's become so cumbersome. And we have we are fraught with this incapacity that permeates these institutions. So, look, I think also that we are moving in the right direction. You saw yesterday the announcements by SIU and Eskom. I know these are different mechanisms. This is work that's being done outside of the areas where we want to see accountability. But I think we're starting to get there. We're hearing behind the scenes that the wheel of justice is starting to turn.
Grinding exceedingly slowly. Colin, I want to bring you in. There are at least some encouraging signs. What do you make of where we find ourselves and the political will to tackle corruption right now?
Let me just be very clear. I think the mood in the country is one of outrage at this point in time. And I'm talking about the broad public, but also within the ANC. And the progressives within the ANC are absolutely outraged at what they're seeing happening around this COVID PPE procurement process and people feeding at the trough of the misery of, you know, hundreds of thousands of South Africans amidst, you know, untold unemployment. It is quite outrageous and really requires a very strong response. So I think the president on Monday had read that mood and came out of it. I would just say, In terms of the legacy of President Ramaphosa, I think there are two things he needs to focus on and achieve. The first is with respect to state capture and this war on corruption. And I think it requires a crack team of people. I'm not an expert like Paul on this area, so I would defer to experts. But it requires an absolute crack team of professionals to go and hunt and prosecute quickly the big and small cases, and to have a kind of sense of momentum in the country that things are happening, that there is consequence for these negative criminal actions. So that's the first thing. And then the second thing is the economy. And the fact is, you know, we're now 2 years into the Ramaphosa administration. He's been knocked very hard by this COVID development, but we need to be much more surgical on our economic plan. And that is obviously where my 10-point economic plan, including promoting a basic income grant to deal with the unemployed problem and create an economic stimulus in the hands of the poor, including writing Eskom and dealing with its balance sheet, including SMEs and getting emergency relief in the hands of business. These are the things that are going to determine, is he successful? Can he crack down on state capture and get a crack team to do that? Can he crack down on economic misery, on unemployment, and get growth going in the economy again? Mm. And he probably needs a crack team of coordinated people in his cabinet, in his administration, to achieve both.
Are they mutually exclusive, Paul, ideas here around dealing with corruption and then stimulating the economy? And to Colin's point, there's a lot of talk now around infrastructure, and we've had 50 projects recently gazetted by José Enzo Ramacorpa. It means they've got 58 days within which to clear away the regulatory bottlenecks. But many, I'm reminded of what Paul Harris, the founder of the First Rand Group, said to me about process. Private sector investors won't work with the government when there is the whiff and taint of corruption. So if we want to get the economy going, it seems that we need to deal with Colin's first point on those two legacy points, and that's dealing with corruption.
Absolutely. I would agree with Colin wholeheartedly, and I'm very pleased to see that item one in his plan is the basic income grant, because if you put money in the hands of poor people, they do not save it, they spend it, and that in itself serves to stimulate the economy. But the real stimulation will come when it is possible to attract foreign direct investment, as well as investment by local people who have their hands on a great deal of wealth that is sitting idle at the moment, because there is no business confidence in the ability of the current government to survive the ravages of the state capture project of the Zuma era, and indeed the corruption which is now manifesting itself. If you boost business confidence by showing that you are serious about corruption, by showing that you have read the Glenister judgments, and by showing your preparedness to implement them in a best practice manner, not minimalistically as the Zuma administration somewhat begrudgingly did on paper, but in fact did not do at all, which facilitated the state capture project. You are not going to persuade anybody who is a nervous investor, anybody who's even an investor, to invest in South Africa. Whereas if you do get serious about corruption, it is the sine qua non of having a plan like Collins, his 10-point plan, or Mike Abel's 5 pivot points. Those will not work. They won't get off the ground if South Africa continues to be, and to be perceived to be, a country in which failure is staring us in the face, because we do not have the political will to counter corruption appropriately and in the manner laid down by law in binding fashion. Everybody complains that I'm continuously advocating the Integrity Commission. What I'm doing is actually reminding government that the correct way to implement the decisions of the Constitutional Court in the various Glenister cases is by creating this new Chapter 9 institution. Mm. They can give it any name they like. So, but if it doesn't have Chapter 9 protection, won't work any better than this.
Advocate Hoffman, is there no way to compel the executive to abide by the decision of the judiciary in this instance? If we look at the role that civil society should be playing here, if the executive is sitting on its hands for an inordinate amount of time, surely there is a case to be made for civil society to compel the executive to implement these decisions.
Yes, Accountability Now has made available not only to the presidency but also to the state attorney and other institutions of government a draft set of papers in which it is envisaged that the Constitutional Court will be approached in order to secure proper compliance with the Glenister judgments. In other words, the inefficiencies and ineffectiveness of the combination of a hollowed out NPA and an undercapacitated AUKUS will be put on the table in the Constitutional Court, and the court will be asked to rule on the matter. I'm not doing that yet, because I still have hope that President Ramaphosa is one of the good guys, and that he does mean it when he says that he wants to take on the corrupt, and that he has difficulties of a political nature. In fact, there is a lack of political will within the corridors of Luthuli House to deal with corruption, because corruption has become a way of life for far too many in the ANC. Some describe it as a large mafia type organization. President Ramaphosa, if he wants to leave a legacy that is worth remembering, is going to have to grasp the nettle of getting away from his current multi-agency approach. And he hasn't ruled out the creation of an integrity commission. He was asked about it in Parliament last year, And when asked, he said, that's a refreshing idea, I'd like to mull it over. And when he was reminded that he was mulling it over, he said, not yet. He didn't say no, he said, not at this stage. Well, I'd like him to say now at this stage, polite, what is going on in relation to the crimes against humanity that are being perpetrated by the COVID preneurs who are proliferating in the ranks of the ANC.
And many speculate about the intestine battles inside the ANC at the NEC level. We see the factions over the weekend arguing in different directions. There's a lot of whataboutism when you raise issues of corruption. And many feel that if the president does have his back up against the wall, what does he have to lose by going headfirst and tackling those in his cabinet, getting rid of them, and instituting something like an integrity commission to demonstrate his willingness to be firm and tough on corruption? I'm reminded of how they got rid of the five mafia families in New York. It was that kind of approach. It was a specialized, targeted legal and criminal investigation where it was coordinated, but there was political will. Wayne, from an ordinary man on the street's perspective, or woman on the street's perspective, there's this issue of frustration. What role can civil society play here to help put some more sunlight into the equation, because sunlight is the best disinfectant here, to ensure there's greater transparency? And I think here in particular of public procurement. There's going to be a lot of public procurement as we look to grow and rebuild post-COVID. Surely that process now has to be completely 100% transparent to ensure that we can start rooting out corruption before we hear about it 4 months afterwards because of a whistleblower.
Yes, exactly. You know, transparency is the enemy of corruption. We've heard that statement many, many times. And if we can get government to take us seriously, society seriously, and ensure that all procurement is what we mean by not just e-procurement, but the process is visible to the public as it starts, as every tender goes out. The flags then get raised very quickly by society, who start to question the participants in the process, as well as the pricing, the timing and the payments thereof. And when that starts to happen, and remember there are thousands and thousands of people that are interested in participating in this process, civil society linked through you know, organized civil society, we can start to put the eyes on procurement. Once the eyes are on procurement, the flags go up faster. And then you stop this nonsense where you see 20 million rand being paid for 14 toilets. Once the money's paid, it's hard to get it back. You've got to stop the money from flowing in those very dubious procurement practices. So it is all about transparency, and the second element is accountability. And I think, coming back to your point, this is the time now for Cyril Ramaphosa to exercise some moral courage, to stand up. He's got time. He's got society behind him. He's got the country behind him. And he needs the support, because with that comes the strength to stand up. He is lacking there. And as you said, the public are extremely frustrated. We get letters daily. I cannot tell you how many, with society just saying we need to do something. We need to do something fast because it's becoming untenable at the moment. But I think we are getting there. We've just got to raise this issue, never let off the accelerator on this, and keep society informed that they have the power. They have the power to make a difference, and they can. They need to just support civil society, organize civil society, and we'll get the job done.
Colin, on the last word, and I know you know the president well, do you think he is weakened inside the party, as many are speculating he is? Or is he now finally, with his letter on Monday, preparing the ground to take these hard decisions and grab the bull by the horns? I see the big bull in the background there in your lounge or wherever you're sitting. Is he going to grasp that bull by the horns, the buffalo soldier?
Well, I certainly hope so. I can't speak on his behalf. What I would like to sort of stress is, in my view, the perfect is the enemy of the good. You know, we can't wait for perfect cases against people that have been in the Zondo Commission who clearly committed crimes. And all of these crimes that we're seeing on a daily basis with this PPE, I think the public wants to see consequence, wants to see action. It wants to see people, as soon as they commit these crimes, going to jail. And you know, it's not the onus on society to have to prove every time before action is taken that things are being done. We have not seen enough consequence, and we need to see that consequence. So I certainly hope the president's fortitude and back is strong and prepared to lean in and crack the whip.
As do so many of us, as Vusi Thembekwayo was saying the other day, if you're not angry right now, you're not paying attention. Thanks to today's panel, Paul Hoffman, Director of Accountability Now, Colin Coleman, Senior Fellow and Lecturer at Yale University's Jackson Institute for Global Affairs, and Wayne Duvernay, CEO of Outer.